Well, good morning. Before I get started, I did just want to take a minute on behalf of my family and just thank you all so much for your generosity, your kindness, your helpfulness to us after Wesley's birth. I really can't describe how much that means to us that we have you guys and that we know that help is a phone call away if we really needed it. And I think part of the reason that means so much to us is just that we know that you all are more than just a group of people who we see every Sunday. You all are family. And that really means a lot to us. That from day one, really, you've cared about us, you've loved on us, and you treat our kids like they're your kids, and you love on them, and it just means a lot to us. And so I know I see some new faces in the audience. I want to let you know that if you're looking for a church to come and be invisible, just kind of sit in the pew and go home and have nobody really pay much attention to you, you found the wrong church. And we found that to be true through our time here. Well, how many of you are familiar with the book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? Maybe you've read it, you've seen it. It's pretty popular. I think it was elementary school when I first read the series, and then my sister and I, over and over growing up, watched the BBC TV adaptation. I don't know if you all know what I'm talking about, but we watched it over and over. I loved it. I can still see some of the scenes in my mind today. But one of the scenes that no matter how many times I watched the movie, no matter how much I knew what was coming next, there was a scene that was always really, really hard for me to watch. And it was the one where the lion, Aslan, who was the leader of Narnia, had chosen to give himself up to the evil white witch in exchange for one of her prisoners. And there is a scene in the book where he is walking to the stone table to meet the witch and her evil creatures, and he knows that it is there where he'll be put to death. And I want to read a little bit of that for you to create a picture in your mind. A howl and a gibber of dismay went up from the creatures when they first saw the great lion pacing toward them. And for a moment, even the witch herself seemed to be struck with fear. Then she recovered herself and gave a wild, fierce laugh. "The fool!" she cried. "The fool has come. Bind him fast." Four hags, grinning and leering, yet also hanging back and half afraid of what they had to do, approached him. "Bind him, I say," repeated the white witch. The hags made a dart at him and shrieked with triumph when they found that he made no resistance at all. Then others rushed in to help them, and between them they rolled the huge lion over on his back and tied all his four paws together, shouting and cheering as if they had done something brave. Though had the lion chosen, one of those paws could have been the death of them all. But he made no noise, even when the enemies, straining and tugging, pulled the cord so tight that they cut into his flesh. Then they began to drag him toward the stone table. "Stop," said the witch. "Let him first be shaved." Another roar of mean laughter went up from her followers as an ogre with a pair of shears came forward and squatted down by Aslan's head. Snip, snip, snip went the shears, and masses of curling gold began to fall to the ground. Then they could see the face of Aslan looking all small and different without its mane. "Why, he is only a great cat after all," cried one. "Is that what we were afraid of?" said another. And they surged round Aslan, jeering at him, saying things like, "Kitty, kitty, poor kitty! And how many mice have you caught today, cat? And would you like a saucer of milk, pussums?" "Muzzle him," said the witch. And even now, as they worked about his face, putting on the muzzle, one bite from his jaws would have cost two or three of them their hands. But he never moved. And this seemed to enrage all that rabble. Everyone was at him now, those who had been afraid to come near him even after he was bound began to find their courage. And the whole crowd of creatures kicked him, hit him, spit on him, jeered at him. I just remember watching that scene as a child thinking, "Do something, Aslan! They're making you look like a fool! Why are you letting them treat you like that?" And the mighty lion seemed so helpless. And his enemies took great pleasure in gloating over his demise. Because they feared no retaliation from him, they mercilessly mocked him and his once great reputation. Doesn't it seem like sometimes this is how our God is treated today in the world? That everywhere we turn, there's this constant slandering of his name and his reputation. We have hundreds of millions of people who don't even acknowledge that he exists. He's simply a figment of the people's imagination. There's nothing special about him. And then you have others who take it a step further, and they explicitly assault his character, even though many of them don't even believe he ever existed. Take this quote from a well-known atheist. "The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it. A petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak. A vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser. A misogynistic, homophobic, racist, genocidal, capriciously malevolent bully." With every statement like this, God's reputation is dragged through the mud. But then there are times when his reputation is perhaps slandered most by those who claim to follow him. You have high-profile ministry leaders. They have affairs. They embezzle money. They commit other kinds of heinous crimes, and the world watches with absolute glee. And God's reputation is dragged through the mud. And we hear this, and it hits us right in the gut. And there are several ways we want to respond. You know, on one end of the spectrum, we might want to fight back. We want to defend God. We want to lash out at those who are saying these things, who are speaking ill of him and his reputation. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we might want to take a more positive approach. After all, we're all headed to heaven in the end, so it's not going to let it get us down. This is just part of following God in a fallen world. It stinks, but you know what? There's nothing we can really do about it. So we'll just kind of let it go. And sometimes, if we're honest, we might take a wholly different approach. And we might even think that it's not that big of a deal at all. Perhaps we've become numb to it. Or maybe we really just don't care that God's reputation is being slandered. And so we just ignore it altogether. But there's another response in Scripture that's prevalent, especially in the Old Testament. And I would suggest it's actually perhaps the ideal response when we find that God's name is being slandered. And it's this: while God's enemies gloat, his people should groan. While God's enemies gloat, his people should groan. Now, I know what you might be thinking. Really? I mean, first, we lose an hour of sleep today, so we're all a little bit cranky because of that. And now, you're going to spend the next 30 minutes trying to convince us to be sad? sort of. But why not? I mean, there are all kinds of other things that we so easily grieve over, right? We mourn when our favorite sports team loses a big game. We mourn when famous celebrities we've never met pass away. And I don't need to tell you all what kind of state of mourning happened in Texas when Bluebell went off the shelves. Those are the kinds of things that we grieve over. So why not express such mourning at the slandering of God's reputation? What if instead of lashing out or just brushing it off, we were to simply stop and groan in mourning? Indeed, that's exactly the approach taken by the man in our text for this morning. We're in 2 Samuel 1. 2 Samuel 1, continuing our journey of pursuing God's blessing together. And there in 2 Samuel 1, we're going to find that David learns of some tragic news that is sure to bring dishonor to God's name. And through this tragedy and then the way that David responds, we're given some sober guidance for God's people today. For when God's reputation is slandered. And here it is. When God's reputation is slandered, we can expect his enemies to gloat. But his people should groan. We can expect God's enemies to gloat, but his people should groan. So if you turn with me to 2 Samuel chapter 1, we're first going to see why God's reputation is under attack here. And we're reminded that when this happens, we can expect God's enemies to gloat. Start in verse 1 of 2 Samuel. After the death of Saul, when David had returned from striking down the Amalekites, David remained 2 days in Ziklag. And on the third day, behold, a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. And when he came to David, he fell to the ground and paid homage. David said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said to him, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." And David said to him, "How did it go? Tell me." Now let's remind ourselves of what's going on here. We've basically had two battles going on at about the same time. On the one side, you've got David and his men who are fighting the Amalekites. And then a little bit further away, you've got Saul and the Israelite army who are going after the Philistines. And what we have here in chapter 1 is David has come back victorious from his battle over the Amalekites. But he has no idea what happened to Saul and the Israelite army with the Philistines. Now, we as readers know what happened. But David does not yet know that the Israelite army was ransacked. And that King Saul and his best friend Jonathan were dead. I know that's hard for us to grasp. We've got this instant information age of 2016. But remember, in that time, David's only way to find out was the old-fashioned way. It's word of mouth. And it's 80 miles from where that battle was taking place to where David is now. And so he had to wait on that messenger to come with the coveted news. How did it go? Tell me. And that's when the messenger delivers the tragic update. Let's continue on there at the end of verse 4. And he answered, "The people fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen and are dead. And Saul and his son Jonathan are also dead." That's pretty hard to overstate how devastating this is for the nation of Israel here. Their king is dead. Who's going to lead them? Who's going to fight for them? Who's going to administer justice in the land for them? But then think about the army. They're defeated. The Philistines are starting to settle in Israelite territory. And so national security is now a huge concern for them. And the nation has to try to regroup, pull itself back together with neither their king nor his son. This news is also devastating for another reason. Because who looks really bad? I think you have to say it's God. I mean, there's no way around it. He's the one who's supposed to be the ultimate leader, the ultimate protector of his people. And he lets this happen to them? Now, of course, we know that the disaster is in large part because of Saul's repeated sin. We're seeing the consequences of that play out, but God's enemies don't care about that. All they see is a nation that has this supposedly wonderful God, and it seems that they've now been abandoned by that God. You can just imagine the taunts, can't you, coming from the enemy? And think about this from the Philistines' perspective. I mean, they've experienced the power of Israel's God before. Remember earlier in 1 Samuel, when he was with Dagon, their god, and he ended up totally humiliating him. His head and his hands were cut off, and it demonstrated that Israel's God, Yahweh, was superior. They have that perhaps in their mind, but this seems to be totally different than that. It doesn't seem like the Philistines are dealing with the same powerful God here. And I would have to think that their confidence at this point is bubbling. In fact, as we saw last week, they have already taken every opportunity to gloat at God's expense. They made sure that news of their victory over Israel's God had spread far and wide to their people. And they went so far as to fasten King Saul's body to the wall to publicly display their dominance. God's reputation has taken a serious hit, and his enemies are all too happy to gloat. In fact, even this messenger seems a little bit too happy about what happened to Saul. Let's pick it back up in verse 5. Then David said to the young man who told him, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" And the young man who told him said, "By chance, I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and there was Saul leaning on his spear, and behold, the chariots and the horsemen were close upon him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called to me, and I answered, 'Here I am.' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' I answered him, 'I am an Amalekite.' And he said to me, 'Stand beside me and kill me, for anguish has seized me, and yet my life lingers.' So I stood beside him and killed him," talking about Saul, "because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the armlet that was on his arm, and I have brought them here to my Lord." It's a little hard to know exactly what to do with this report here, because it seems to contradict what the narrator told us in the last chapter. That's what we saw last week with Luke. When it talks about the battle, in that account, Saul was really badly wounded, so he asked his armor bearer to kill him because he doesn't want to fall into the hands of the Philistines, perhaps be tortured, that they mistreat him. But his armor bearer refused. And so Saul, again, according to the narrator, ended up taking his own life. Now, it's possible that this messenger's account is true. Maybe it just adds a little bit more detail. Maybe it fills in the blanks a little bit to the narrator's story. It's also possible that the messenger is making the whole thing up. Either way, the implication is that he is expecting to profit from what's happened here. I mean, it's really sort of politics at its finest. We see it explicitly a little bit later in chapter 4, but this messenger thinks he's bringing good news to David. Because surely David's going to be happy that Saul is dead, right? Because Saul has been the only one standing between David and the throne that was rightfully his. And so this messenger is just sure that his news was going to make David a very happy man. And in return, perhaps the messenger could expect to get something from David when he becomes king. And when you think about it, I mean, that is the reaction we would expect from David, right? I mean, Saul had repeatedly tried to kill him. He had made David's life a constant flight for survival. And on top of that, David was the one with the true claim to the throne, but he wouldn't harm Saul. And so he wasn't actually going to get to sit on that throne until Saul was out of the picture, and now he is. And David doesn't even have to get his hands dirty. This seems like a good win for David. Saul is dead. The people will look to him to provide leadership. He can finally take the throne and all will be well. But when he hears the news, David has just one thing on his mind. And it wasn't at all what the messenger was expecting. Look at verses 11 and 12. Then David took hold of his clothes and tore them. And so did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and for Jonathan his son and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. You see, what the messenger didn't count on is that David's focus was not on his own interests. And that more than anything, David was grieved at how this tragedy was an assault on God's reputation. We see that more clearly demonstrated a little bit later. Look at verses 19 and 20. This is part of David's lament over what had happened in that battle. And notice the focus at the beginning. Verse 19. Your glory, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath, publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon. These are Philistine cities. Lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised exult. You see, David couldn't bear the thought of the Philistines celebrating the victory. And it wasn't just that David was mad Israel had lost. The bigger issue here was that there was now a huge opportunity for God's enemies to gloat about God's defeat. And David could not stand the thought of his God's reputation being mercilessly mocked. And because of that focus, his reaction was to mourn. There was no joy at how he might profit politically from this. He didn't lash out in anger, though we might have understood if he had jumped up and gathered his troops and run to attack the Philistines in revenge. And he didn't just shake it off. Well, I'm sure God will get him next time. It's no biggie. You know, you win some, you lose some. Let's just move on. No, none of those things. Instead, he simply stops and he groans in mourning. God's reputation has taken a serious hit. And while his enemies are all too happy to gloat, his people groan. Let me put it another way. When God's name is defamed and his enemies rejoice, God's people can embrace the opportunity to mourn. What's the point? I mean, really, what's the point? It's not like being sad is going to necessarily help God's reputation. So is this like some kind of pity party kind of mourning? We get upset and we grieve and then maybe we can feel better about ourselves and how things are going. No, it's just the opposite. Because you see, we don't mourn and groan when God's name is slandered so that we feel better about ourselves. We mourn to draw attention off of ourselves and on to God. More specifically, I would suggest there are at least two important truths that such groaning can constantly remind us of. First, our groaning reminds us that God's reputation is a big deal. I think deep down we know that. But we're often so wrapped up in our own lives and in our own reputations that it's easy to lose sight of God's reputation and why it ought to be so precious to us. I had the privilege of having my mom, who is here, by the way. Thank you for all of your prayers for her. She's doing well. I had the privilege of having her as my high school English teacher for 3 out of the 4 years of high school. Now, of course, as you can imagine at the time, I didn't really think it was all that much of a privilege. And I remember very vividly, eighth grade, I don't know what we called it, maybe the preview day for going to high school. So we were nearing the end of eighth grade. All of us went to the high school. It was in a separate building. We got to meet the teachers. We got to get a feel for what it was like, where the classrooms are, where the lockers are and everything. And we got a feel for what it was like to be in high school. Well, of course, my mom came with me, but there was a catch. She was my mom, but she was about to be my teacher. Now, as any immature, self-centered teenager would think, I didn't want to be seen with my mom. I was too cool for that. The first day that I'm there learning about high school, I don't want to be labeled as that teacher's pet hanging around with her. And so I tried to distance myself. I didn't want her messing with my reputation. And as my freshman year started, inevitably, I would hear some of the gossip that would go amongst the students. And some of it would be about my mom. Now, I never joined in with it, but at first I didn't also really do a whole lot to stop it either. You know, it was the typical stuff, grumbling and complaining. But I was much more interested in making sure that I preserved my reputation. And I was afraid that if I were to jump in and take more of an interest in hers, that would damage my reputation. And I didn't want to do that. But as I got older, there was this shift in my attitude toward how my mom was treated. And by the time I was set to graduate, I didn't really care so much what the other students thought of me. I didn't really care if they saw me with my mom, if I was some kind of teacher's pet because my mom happened to be my teacher. What I did care about was when the other students talked badly about her. Because I was no longer neutral. I'd matured enough to know that her reputation should be far more important to me than my own and my own social standing at the school. And I wanted to do everything that I could to help protect that for her. That's a natural thing for us, right? Those we love, those we care about, we want to protect their reputation. Is that how we feel about God's reputation? That it's more important than our own interests, our own reputations? That we yearn to protect it at all costs? You see, making it a practice to mourn when God's reputation is attacked, that reminds us we're not the center of the universe. It reminds us that as much as we like to look out for ourselves, as much as we like to protect our own reputations, we ought to care that much more about God's reputation. And so every time we pause to groan that God's name has been slandered, we're reminded again of just how precious His name and His reputation are. And how careful we need to be that we represent Him well to the world so that we don't find ourselves part of the problem of bringing dishonor to His name. Groaning reminds us that God's reputation, it's a big deal. Second, groaning reminds us that there is something better yet to come. Because every time we mourn the defamation of God's name, we're given a tangible reminder that, you know what, things are not now as they should be. But it also gives us the opportunity to look forward with anticipation to the day when they will. When we never again have to worry about God's reputation being slandered. Because it will not happen. Because all will rightly recognize Him for who He is and will bow before Him and worship Him. Groaning in the here and now can make that future that we long for all the more sweet to us because it's not the experience that we have right now. And so the next time someone makes an offensive joke about God, and the next time a big tragedy happens and inevitably the claims come, Oh, some great God he is. Couldn't even stop that from happening. When these things happen and God's character is slandered, perhaps the best thing that we can do is pause and groan. Yes, there may be other legitimate responses that we can have. I'm not discounting that. But let us not miss the opportunity to groan for God's reputation. And may such groaning remind us of the sacredness of his name and of his reputation. And may it help us to look forward with anticipation to the day when never again will God's name be slandered.